Top 100 Project
and action.
Good evening, and thanks much for tuning in to the Top 100 Project, where we review the AFI's 1998 and 2007 lists of the 100 greatest American movies. Spoiler alert about a very spoilable movie. If you haven't seen this picture and want to remain uninformed, then get out now. Are you still here? I'm Ryan Ellis with the most confident showerer I know, my wife Bev.
That's me.
We're also here with Fox. He's very excited about this podcast about Psycho.
So excited that he's panting.
He's going to pant the
mostly because it's hot.
So the coming attraction trivia for Psycho. What earned the most money during its initial theatrical release? Hitchcock's original Psycho, Psycho 2 in 1983, or the Gus Van Sant remake in 1998?
The original Psycho?
Well, if you adjust for inflation, then yes. It's $250 million better, but the original actual totals would be Psycho 2.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Sequels. That's why they always make them. They always do well.
Yeah, it made $3 million more than the original one did.
Wow. What year did you say it came out?
83.
Worth adjusting for inflation, I guess, with the difference like that.
Mm-hmm.
But that being said, sorry, Gus Van Sant. Bummer.
Yeah, his movie wasn't very successful. Psycho, as in the original movie, is 140th on Box Office Mojo's all-time list of adjusted for inflation hits.
It was one of the last black and white films to really do that well on the box office, because following this, they stopped making so many black and white films.
We already said last week, The Apartment, which won Best Picture, is the last movie to win that award and be black and white.
That's right.
For 33 years.
Yeah.
And that was Schindler's
List. Now it's a total gimmick to shoot something in black and white. It's very intentional.
And it also is not an easy thing to get to shoot black and white. You either are a nobody who can do whatever you want to because a movie costs $20.
Yeah.
Or yes, you're a big player and you said, I'm going to do this, but only if it's in black and white.
You're Spielberg.
Yeah,
Mickey Schindler's List.
Yeah. All right, well, I guess we've made it clear, but the 59th edition of the Top 100 Project is Alfred Hitchcock's Psycho, which was 18th on AFI's 1998 Top 100 between John Huston Products, The African Queen, and Chinatown. Then it knifed up four spots to 14th in 2007 between sci-fi Trailblazers, Star Wars, and 2001 A Space Odyssey. Paramount gave Psycho a premiere in New York City on June 16, 1960. Then they spun it out wide in August and September. Reviews were mixed, but it was Hitchcock's, as we said, biggest hit.
Mm-hmm.
Bev will describe that hit for you with the skinny.
Janet Leigh is Marion Crane, a secretary from Phoenix who steals thousands of dollars and drives out to California to meet her boyfriend, Sam, played by John Gavin. Stopping at a motel on a rainy night, Marion meets Norman Bates, played by Anthony Perkins, the lonely and jittery proprietor of the Bates Motel. After Marion is murdered by Norman's supposedly invalid mother, Sam and Marion's sister Lila, played by Vera Miles, investigate.
Interesting that we'd have a skinny on this because we didn't for, I think it was Wizard of Oz, where you kind of mocked me and said, dude, everyone knows what this movie's about. Psycho is probably the same.
Yeah, this movie's pretty much familiar to just about everybody. Although I will say, I saw the remake first, Gus Van Sant's remake. When I went in to see that movie, I actually didn't know the very ending. I knew that Anne Heche wasn't going to make it to the second act, but I didn't know that he had multiple personalities and that he was actually his mother. That twist had never been revealed to me somehow.
So you thought Mother really was alive.
Yeah, I was like waiting to find out what that was all about.
And it's an interesting thing in this movie. We said it during a break when we watched the movie, that you could actually try to see it through the eyes of somebody who believes Mother really is killing Marion. And she's really killing Arbogast, the PI, and she's really the threat. And Norm is just covering up for her.
And you sympathize with him completely, right? If you see it that way, he's a very sympathetic character. He's somebody, of course, who's protecting her, but has an overbearing mother. You can kind of sympathize. You would probably expect that the last scene of the film would be a conflict between him and his mother, where he probably overcomes her and ends up being the hero of the film.
Rather than the great twist.
Yeah.
All right, so we've gone way on past where I usually do, which is to read the nutshell.
Yes, please read
it. That's okay.
Nutshell.
It's hard to take it back here, but in a nutshell with Psycho, amateur taxidermist feeds, houses, then lacerates larcenous secretary. Was that worth going back to? Maybe not. So as we always say about these movies, we're going to spoil them. There's maybe five we've done so far that people probably know whether they actually have seen the movie or not. This is certainly one of them. We've already discussed plenty of things about it. Let's get back to the crux of it. Your thumb up or your thumb down?
Definitely thumb up. Thumb up. If it was just a matter of recommending a movie or not, I would recommend any of the Hitchcock movies we've seen. But I've said over and over, because this is the fourth one that we've done on the project, as we've watched each one, I keep saying that I have yet to see the Hitchcock film that really wins me over. But I think this is the one. Like, I really love this movie. I wasn't into it until Norman is introduced. But as soon as we have Perkins' magnificent performance carrying the plot, I am all in. So finally, a Hitchcock film that really engaged me.
The high rankings, 18th and 14th. Do you agree with those rankings?
I think I do, because it's a film I enjoyed and you could sink your teeth into, really. Also super entertaining, but more than anything, you can't deny its influence, its popularity, its success, its influence. That's the single biggest
reason.
Right. If you look at the criteria for what puts something on the list, this film really meets them all.
More than some of the ones that finished higher, I would say. As much as we've loved some of the great films and as much as we respect some of the other ones that mm-hmm. are in the top 10 or top 12. Hey, we talked about Vertigo a few weeks ago, making the top 10, and we didn't agree with it doing that. The Sight and Sound list has it number one. They did that a few years ago. But I think we can at least understand to an extent why they did that. But if you talk about what at least this list criteria looks for, I can't speak for the Sight and Sound. Psycho is easily the more influential.
Mm.
Better is such a subjective thing, but mm-hmm. you look at their criteria, neither one of them won awards. In fact, all four Hitchcock movies on this list, not one of them won a single Academy Award.
Yeah.
His films didn't win many awards anyway, but none of these ones won anything. So you can't go by that. So then it comes down to cultural impact, and it comes down to the money it made. All four movies were successful. Well, not Vertigo, actually. Three of the movies were successful.
Yeah.
But then, of course, influence. And you don't get much more influential in the entire list than this one.
Yeah, I guess there could be a debate whether or not this film influenced cinema in a good way or a bad way, because it made cinema more violent. It made cinema more lewd. And this was the beginning of the end of the code.
Was the beginning of the slasher era, but it didn't really take effect, truly, the slasher era until 18 years later with Halloween, which was absolutely one of the things that was influenced by this film.
And stars Janet Leigh's daughter, Jamie Lee Curtis. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and John Carpenter uses some characters' names. Loomis.
Mm-hmm.
The doctor is named Loomis, and that's Sam's actual last name.
Ah.
And there are many other things that are based on the two. And as for the code, it wasn't gone yet, but it was definitely taking more of a backseat. We talked about the code so much in the early part of the project when we did 30s and 40s movies, because they had to abide by it completely.
Mm-hmm.
And now we're getting to the point where you actually do see the stand-in for Janet Leigh, her breasts in blurred, but you see them as she pulls the curtain back. I read about this years ago, and when I had the DVD, and certainly the Blu-ray, which is what we watched, and it looked pretty damn good, in fact.
Mm-hmm.
It isn't even that hard to look for it.
Yeah.
And somehow the production code didn't see that.
It goes by very quickly. There's a lot of really fast cutting, and it's intentionally confusing, and you could just not recognize exactly what you're looking at, and then it's over so quickly. And you're very distracted by what's happening in the scene.
You've hit on a good point, because that's one thing that they wouldn't have even thought of up until when we were young people in the 80s, maybe even well into the 90s, that people would rewatch scenes. They'd freeze frame scenes. They'd step by step through
them. That's right.
Because if you had a VHS tape in the 80s and 90s, you wouldn't see it very clearly because of things like tracking issues. And with mm-hmm. film, people didn't do that with film. They watched it straight through. That was it. So yeah, maybe you're right about that.
Yeah.
Maybe it simply was that they couldn't tell. But it's very obvious if you look, though.
I'm sure if you just Google image search, I'm sure you can see it everywhere.
Mm-hmm. All right, so this is the final bona fide horror movie on the list until we get to The Sixth Sense, which is almost at the end. That'll be 63 AFI movies from now. The only other horror films, and we had this whole debate way back when we did Frankenstein about how there are only three true horror films on the list. Frankenstein, Psycho, Sixth Sense. Jaws and Silence of the Lambs are debatable.
Mm-hmm.
But if we're going to stick with the three that we said, Frankenstein was 50 AFI movies ago. And mm-hmm. if we're going to include Jaws for the sake of argument, because it's debatably horror, that's still 31 AFI movies.
Yeah.
Horror is not respected by the AFI.
Yeah, it's like a second-class citizen.
But here's the irony of this movie. We're going to get to the AFI credits later. There are plenty of them. Number one thriller in the history of the AFI.
Mm-hmm.
That did not surprise me when I saw that list. Yeah. They went to break for the top three. I knew it was going to be Exorcist, Jaws, Psycho, and that's exactly what it was. 3, 2, and 1. The irony is that there are only about 4, 5, maybe 6 scenes in this movie that are in any way scary, shocking, whatever else, but they are so effective and powerful.
Do you find it scary?
No.
Me neither.
However, I said at the top, you're the most confident showerer I know. You're a woman. Even a guy could feel this way. But seeing this movie, or even just knowing that it's out there, it's planted that seed in your head. Has it ever messed with you? Just like swimming in an ocean, the shark and Jaws might mess with you that way.
I'm sure at some weak moments, I've probably been... When you're in a strange bathroom, you lock the door, right?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if it's because of this movie or not, but it's probably because of this movie.
It probably is planted that seed.
Yeah.
Okay, so as far as the scares go, in total, there are things that play on a person's nerves more than they are truly horrifying, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I guess the first one would be when Marion sees her boss on the street after she's stolen the money from that jerk who's pretty much dared her to do it.
Yeah.
And you could argue that that's a good scare scene, or at least a good thrill moment.
Mm-hmm.
The second one is when she sees the cop,
mm-hmm.
and he pulls her over, interrogates her, but then, of course, he seems to be stalking her. Now, maybe that's all in her head. Hitchcock didn't usually play that whole, like, is it real, is it not real moment. very often in his films, especially in this one. This movie tends to be pretty realistic and pretty gritty.
If it wasn't all in her head, why on earth would she have bought the new car?
Right in front of him?
Right in front of him. What's the point of switching cars if the cop that you're trying to get away from is watching you buy the new car?
Mm-hmm. So yeah, that's one of those things that raises questions right there.
It could just be, you mentioned this when we were watching, it could just be her conscience.
Yeah, but Hitchcock was notoriously terrified of police and authority. And that scene was in there, I'm sure, at least in part because of that. It plays off his fears of being thrown in jail. And then the next scare would be the shower scene, obviously. That's the next big throw moment. We're going to talk about that plenty in this podcast a little later on. I guess the next one for that would be Arbogast's murder.
Mm-hmm.
And his death is shocking and undeserving. He doesn't deserve to die like that, but he is trespassing.
Yeah.
And also, Arbogast's murder is the game changer, assuming you think the mother has killed him. If you think the mother's alive, you know, Norman has said she's an invalid. He stutters on that. And of course, that's not true. We know that later. But if you don't know the twist in this movie, it's really interesting to think that, okay, Norman's lying or he's wrong. Maybe the mother's lying to him.
Mm-hmm.
And why would she kill him for daring to trespass? But of course, we know that Norman's skulking around and kills Arbogast, that great shot from above, that God's eye point of view that Hitchcock used every once in a while, not a lot. And then that back projection is Arbogast falls down the stairs and then gets slaughtered even more by that knife.
As a personal opinion, I do not like that shot. The rear projection.
Yeah, I'm not a huge fan either.
It just takes you away from it because it's so phony. That's all. It's a cool looking shot, but if you really want to scare people, make it actually look like he's falling down the stairs.
They maybe should just cast a stunt man and have him just fall down normally.
Yeah. I mean, it's a cool looking shot, and I know that's why he did it, because he wanted to do something neat. But in my opinion, it didn't work. If I was in the cutting room, I would have argued to reshoot and lose it.
You know what it reminds me of is another horror film, The Omen, which has some great thrills and scares in it. And early on, when the mother falls, not down a staircase, but falls from a high height and lands on the floor, what they did was they shot that sideways. And they had Lee Remick going towards a set that looks like the floor with the exploded fishbowl and the fish. Not, they're not real fish, obviously, anyway. But they're tacked to it sideways.
Huh.
And then the water and all that stuff. There may not be water in that shot. If you look at it closely when they explain it, it actually really makes a lot of sense.
That's a cool technique.
That's how they do that. And I think it may be more effective in the same kind of ballpark.
I mean, I respect that he tries something different, but in my opinion, it weakens it.
Mm-hmm.
Anyways, carry on. What was next?
The next thrill would be, I suppose, when they're investigating the hotel, and then when Vera Miles, now she's skulking around in a house that we now know houses a murderer. Or, okay, again, let's play off the notion that mother's alive.
Mm-hmm.
There's a murderer in this house. She's been taken out of the basement. We've seen that earlier.
And then Vera Miles goes down to the basement.
Well, before we get to that, hang on. They're still in the office, me and the two guys, who look very similar. John Gavin, who plays Sam.
Yes.
And Anthony Perkins, who plays Norman, are very similar looking guys.
Both handsome young men, brunettes. Mm-hmm.
They have their little fight, and then Norman runs into the house. Now what's going to happen? And as you point out, maybe this is the big conflict. He's got to stop her from killing the girl. Maybe he's going to help her kill the girl because she's trespassing.
Yeah.
But then one of the most chilling shots I've ever seen in any movie, still, I've probably seen this shot, and I'm not kidding, got to be 75 times. Between watching the movie several times over the years, seeing it on YouTube, watching the documentary again, watching the last scene of this movie more than a few times beyond just actually watching the movie. When he comes into that basement with the mother getup on, the wig and the knife in his hand, the dress, and that crazy look on his face. It isn't quite as effective as it used to be, but it makes my skin crawl.
You know what's the part of the movie that actually scares me, or like gave me chills more when I thought about it afterwards? It's the scene in the room with all the birds.
Yeah.
When they're just having that conversation, and when you first meet Norman Bates, you feel sorry for him, and you want to relate to him, and you want to help him, just like Marion wants to help him. She wants to try and talk him out of taking care of his mean mother, right? He's both convincing that he could be a good person who's simply troubled, but then it's also convincing when you go back later and think about it and think he's a murderer. And I think it's just a reminder that we can all be sucked in. We can all trust people who can hurt us. People who are extremely troubled and just all the way crazy can still trick us into trusting them. That's the part that's scariest to me.
You're right. That's the scene people have talked about a lot over the years, because there isn't any overt violence in it. It leads up to him peeping on her, though.
Mm-hmm.
As soon as she goes into her room, he pulls back that picture and he's got that pre-planned hole.
Yeah.
And it makes you wonder two things. How many times has he peeped on women before?
Mm-hmm.
And how many other women has he killed?
Yeah.
With his mother's id, whatever you call it, in the back of his mind, that's told him, You want that girl, but you're messed up. You're so messed up that if you can't enter her the old-fashioned way, you're going to do it with a knife.
Mm-hmm.
And how many times has he done that in that room? It just so happens that Lila and Sam and the investigator Arbogast, who's been hired by Janet Leigh's company
That's right.
So he probably killed people before who don't have... Yeah, exactly. The ultimate Hitchcock MacGuffin.
Yeah.
Because not only is it something that everybody wants in the movie, the main character in the movie ends up being Norman, and he doesn't even know it exists.
Yeah, it goes away.
Not only does he not want it, he doesn't know it is even there.
Yeah.
And that's so rare in the MacGuffin history, where people usually want it, but maybe they don't know why they want it. They may keep it from somebody else, like in North by Northwest, where Cary Grant doesn't care what's on that microfilm, but he wants to keep away from the bad guys, from the commies. There are two other moments in the thrills department I want to mention. One would be the very ending, which has been derided by many people over the years. But before we get to that part, we'll talk about the moment when he's sinking Marianne's car. That great touch where the car won't go down into the water. And for a second, it stops. And again, it makes you wonder how many cars are in that lake or that swamp, I guess, that he's sunk before. Maybe they're piling up. Maybe that's why it won't go down. Yeah, for some reason it does.
Yeah.
What a great touch, because right from that moment, you go from, of course you don't want this guy to get away with this. Now again, we don't know he's actually the murderer if you go by the logic of not knowing the spoiler. But he's covering up a murder.
Yes.
Yeah. In a pretty terrible way, too. So, of course, your logic, your good person sense shouldn't be that he gets away with this. But the instant that car stops, your heart stops, too. Because, like, that needs to sink. And then the last moment, there's not really a thrill, but that part of the end, and it's been criticized by every critic about how the psychiatrist, played by Simon Oakland, and we're going to see him again in West Side Story, he explains that Norm is a transvestite, which was a controversial word. But he's also a split personality who thinks he's his mother.
Yeah, chiefly he's a split personality.
But if that word was controversial, the censors did not like that word, transvestite.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
The exposition lasts about 3 times longer than it needs to. Mm-hmm. They really have to draw it out, play to the cheap seats in the back.
If it had ended, and I guess it couldn't really truly have ended, but if it had ended with that last shot of Vera Miles discovering mother in that spinning, rotating chair. Now, why does the chair rotate when she reaches Mrs. Bates? And it spins around. You see it's just a skeleton, a stuffed skeleton. The taxidermist is just at the top. He stuffed his mother. That great setup, too, earlier about how he stuffed the birds.
And he stuffed his mother. Also kind of a roundabout code for sex. Stuffing birds. Birds is a euphemism for girls.
Mm-hmm.
And he stuffed his mother, which everybody generally accepts that there was something weird going on with
him.
She
would have had to have abused him, for sure.
Oh, yeah. For him to be this messed up.
And then he clearly killed both his stepfather and, or the lover, I guess he was, and then his mother. And then grave robbed, presumably. Took her back out of the grave and then did this thing with her. So as she spins around, well, she, the body, spins around in the chair, Vera Miles smacks that light bulb, which is a great effect, too. As she shrieks and the thing swings around, so you get this crazy light effect. Down comes Norman, the moment I talked about already, and then John Gavin, luckily, comes back, too, after being knocked out in the office to grab him at the last second and pull open the clothes so that the wig gets knocked off. If you look at it closely, you can tell that they're working together, that Norman swings his head around so the wig will come off. And Sam is pulling up the dress to pull that away so you can see who she is. And also, or he, I should say, interesting little thing there, she, he. But then also there's that dub, which I think I read somewhere wasn't in the original release, but I'm Norma Bates. Do you remember hearing that?
No. Yeah, there's so much going on in that scene, all these details, because I've only seen it once. Like, I didn't pick up on most of these details.
In that moment, as John Gavin just barely manages to save Vera Miles from getting slashed, you hear that in a voiceover. And you could actually tell that Anthony Perkins isn't saying anything. But, Norma Bates! Which actually is kind of creepier in a way, because who's really saying that? There's the skeleton there that really was Norma Bates.
Mm-hmm.
And there's Norman. And by the way, there's an obvious thing. Norma, Norman, almost the exact same name. And also an anagram. Almost an anagram, not quite. Marion and Norman. Pretty close to being an anagram as well.
Oh, what do you know?
And then also the play on the word normal. Because, of course, Norman Norman and Norma were not normal when they were both alive and well.
Yeah.
And obviously we know from this movie. It's such a weird thing to talk about a movie that we all know what happens in it, but we also have to pretend that Norma really was the killer. But somewhere in that, Norman took over her personality in his own. And that's a question I had for you. Is it not even more scary? Okay, maybe the seventh scare. I think we've said six already. Maybe we've said seventh. But the last scare is what happens in that house at night. We've all seen the ghost story movies, and some of them are very effective over the years. But here's one where this guy is so insane, he's walking around his house, in particular his mother's bedroom, pretending he's her.
That's what's going on in that house.
And that's terrifying. Well, that's what we first encounter when Marion gets there.
That's why it takes him so long to come to the door. He has to take the dress and the wig off and go back to being Norman.
Yeah. And as many critics have pointed out, there's such a great touch that Perkins brings this role. Now, we talked about how James Stewart, you didn't seem to agree, but he was great in Vertigo, but was overlooked for an Oscar, for whatever that means anyway. And now here's a performance that absolutely was overlooked by the Academy.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
One of the great ones of all time. And because Perkins plays it like such a boy next door, trivia question. What is he always nibbling on? Or at least a few times he's nibbling on this movie.
Candy corn.
Right. Spelled with two K's. Oh, yeah.
Very childlike, too.
Exactly.
Because he does still have that kind of childishness mm-hmm. about him. And I noticed that occasionally in scenes, especially nearer to the end, when you're looking for it, he has some very feminine gestures. He'll walk away and he'll swing his hips. There's a scene where he's walking up the stairs of the house, and he just has his hand in this very delicate way on the banister. And when you're looking for those details, you see that's him becoming his mother, right?
Mm.
He's embodying that.
Earlier in the film, he's got his hand stuffed in his pockets like a little kid would do.
Yeah.
And then his childlike room with stuffed animals.
Yeah, that's right.
He hasn't grown up at all, obviously.
He wants time to stand still.
Yeah.
He murdered his mother 10 years ago, but mm-hmm. he doesn't want to grow up. He doesn't want anything to change. He's just stuck in that time.
The body contours are still in the bed.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Does he sleep there? Does he sleep as his mother? Does he, when no one's there, does he act like her, maybe not all the time, but almost all the time?
Yeah.
And then what snaps him out of it? He's still sane enough that when he hears a car, oh, this is still business because I am a hotel proprietor.
Mm-hmm.
For what little business there is, because the main highway has taken away most of the business.
But presumably the day would come when Norman would stop existing and mm-hmm. nobody would come to the office to offer people rooms, or transvestite man in a dress would come and let people into their motel rooms.
And would he be able to live himself and not be a killer?
Ooh, good question, because that's the other reason he vacillates back and forth, is because he can't live with himself.
Yeah. He wants these women, and then we say women because we're going to assume he's done this more than once. And in fact, I think the psychiatrist even says women in his explanation at the end about how Norman has done this before. But he can't do anything about it because of how messed up he is. And that's one of the things about this movie that you could get into. An entire podcast could just be about the duplicity of what this character, at least. And of course, so many movies that have dealt with cross-dressing and transvestitism and sexuality, homosexuality, and Anthony Perkins was closeted gay for many years.
Yeah, that's right.
I think he came out towards the end of his career, but he certainly wasn't out in 1960.
Well, he died of AIDS, so he probably was forced to come out just like lots of other people.
Rock Hudson had
that
crisis.
Point, yeah.
Before him, I think, yeah.
He was married, but it was revealed later that he had all these affairs with different men.
Right. So anybody who watches this movie who might feel the way they did about Basic Instinct, and I don't think that movie's saying this, but a lot of people took the message to be that if you're a lesbian, you want to kill everybody. If you're gay, you want to kill everybody. Because you can't deal with your own sexuality.
Hmm.
I don't think it's fair to say that that's what movies are implying. I think that's what this one does in a very indirect way. But it's funny that the movie is called Psycho as well, because, again, it plays in that double notion. If you know the twist, it gives away what's going to happen with Norman. But if you don't know the twist, then the psycho is the mother.
Yep.
Here's one of the ultimate misdirect movies. It starts out being about a crime, about Marion stealing money mm-hmm. from a guy. And maybe is it going to be that Norman's going to help her out? Is he going to get involved? Is it going to be a love triangle? Is she going to fall for Norman? And then Sam comes into the picture. Sam does come into the picture, but of course Marion's long gone. But then all that's washed out the window when Mother Norman kills her for what doesn't seem to be any logical reason. Now let's talk about the most famous scene in this movie, and one of the most famous scenes in any movie in the history of film, the shower scene. So you've seen the remake, which was infamously a shot-for-shot remake. There's some additions, and one of the key additions is before the shower scene when Norman's spying on her. In the remake, they show him masturbating.
Mm-hmm.
By the way, the word masturbate, apparently, Hitchcock would say about Perkins, he's masturbates all the time.
Oh,
master
of course.
As in mystery, you know, you call a young kid master. He would call them that all the time. But in the remake, he actually does masturbate. I don't think they need to add that addition.
No, it seems
it really
like
hits
too
her
much.
Over the head.
Also, don't you want him to still remain a sympathetic character at that point? Mm-hmm. Okay, he spies on girls and we know that he's troubled, but do we want him to cross a line into something that's off-putting to the audience?
Mm-hmm.
Somebody spying on a pretty girl, you can kind of forgive. But spying on a pretty girl while yanking it, that's going to make you a far less sympathetic character. And it's very important to the success of the movie that he's a sympathetic character.
And he would have used a kitchen knife to make that sandwich for her, to cut it into half. Same knife that he brings in there. And Speaking of he, meaning Anthony Perkins, he was apparently never on set for the shower scene. People have talked many times about how there's different people that they use in that scene. And there's all kinds of reports on who was actually the person that acted that character. I think it was many people that did, but it was never him. You do see the eyes if you look really closely, and the Blu-ray brings them out even more, but they don't look like his eyes. You just can sort of see eyes. That very first moment where she yanks back the curtain and they cut to Marion and she's screaming, you can see the eyes. But from that point on, you really can't tell who it is that's doing this.
Mm-hmm.
And it is set up so well by the whole, she's an invalid, but now she's down there in the hotel. Where did Norman go?
Yeah.
So you're playing into the whole back and forth of who really did this. Now, we said already that you can see Marley Renfro. She's the model that played Janet Leigh in some of the shots where she is naked, although you don't see her naked in any one shot except for that one out of focus shot where she pulls the curtain. You can see her breasts. But interestingly, both she and Janet Leigh, would wear what they call moleskin a lot of the time to cover up key body parts. Mm-hmm. During the scene, you never see any, except for that one moment, you never see any key body parts, and you also never see the knife enter the flesh. It's more suggestive than it is. I mean, it's obviously very violent, but it's not violence in the usual sense the way we think of a slasher movie now.
Yeah, where they would show it, but they don't. They show the blood going down the drain. To me, the most gruesome shot is when it's all over, and it cuts from the drain to her dead, dead eye.
Great cut, too, yeah.
Great cut, yeah, exactly. Blood going down the drain, that's her life. Mm-hmm. Clearly she's dead, and this is the main character that we have 100% identified with. The entire film is from exclusively her perspective until this point. Oh, mm-hmm. Except for Norman in the room watching her.
But still, mostly her perspective, because we still think at this point that the movie's about her.
Absolutely. So it's very shocking to see that she's dead, and I think that that's something that kind of calls to mind how you really feel when somebody dies unexpectedly, because it's just the last thing that you see coming.
And also she ends up in this really awkward pose, face down on the bathroom floor, hanging
it's
out of
gruesome.
The...
gruesome.
It is, especially
gruesome.
For 1960.
But it's what a corpse would do. Mm-hmm. Like, a corpse would fall in an awkward pose that no human would hold.
Mm-hmm. And it maybe should have been a tip-up of this big star was cast with the "and" credit. It was "and" Janet Leigh.
Yeah, I was watching that. But that's how he got away with not putting her first build.
Mm-hmm.
Not that Vera Miles has more screen time than her.
No.
I wouldn't say that she did. It's really Anthony Perkins' movie.
Yeah.
He should get top billing.
And he does.
And it, I don't think it's a stretch to bill Janet Leigh second. But she would have been the bigger star at the time. Anthony Perkins was kind of a clean-cut, heartthrob-type guy at this point. He was a pop star, something like a Justin Timberlake, somebody who was probably even that much more clean-cut and somebody that people probably thought that they knew on a personal level rather than just an actor who played roles that you'd be familiar with. So for him to stretch this much and to play this much of a bad character, it's an interesting bit of counter-casting.
Well, Fox is turned down by the shower scene, so let's continue talking about that. Hitchcock liked to set key scenes in bathrooms. That's a trait about Stanley Kubrick, too. We're going to get to him pretty soon now with Spartacus. And they both had a lot of key scenes set in bathrooms. North by Northwest had some where Cary Grant hid in bathrooms and did this and that. Mm-hmm. And this movie, of course. Also, Janet Leigh starts the movie in a hotel room with Sam, which is the closest we ever come to a romantic, happy moment in the movie is the opening. And it's not romantic at all.
It's not even all that
discussion
happy.
Of a let's get married, but it's all about working out the financial details because he has to pay alimony. That's which is why she steals the money.
Yeah.
Now, a bit of a sidebar yet again. Did she plan to steal this money all along and was waiting for opportunity, or was it just the Frank Albertson character kind of proposition? Sure, she just realizes this is the moment.
Yeah, I think that's what it is. It's set up that she's
impulsive.
Just had this encounter with her boyfriend who she's in love with. They're talking about how badly they need money, and then this slimy jerk basically hands her $40,000 cash and is like, I can afford to replace this if it got lost, and by the way, I'd like to proposition you for sex in the grossest manner possible so that nobody would ever blame you for victimizing me. I clearly deserve it. Everything about that scene is just begging her to steal the money. So it seems to me that that was definitely an improv act of theft.
All right. Beginning back to the shower scene where she essentially pays for this one transgression that she's ever had. Seems to be a clean-cut woman who's not really done anything wrong before.
Who had just changed her mind about going home and turning herself
in. Her conversation with Norman. He unintentionally makes her do the right thing before he makes her pay for it.
Yeah.
And again, he doesn't even know why he's doing this in
the
direct way. And
he thinks she's paying for his being sexually desirable.
Yeah. And now, did you notice as well that she starts the movie in the hotel room with Sam. She ends the movie in a hotel bathroom with Norman.
Mm-hmm.
One was sexual. One has sexuality elements of it. She's naked. He's penetrating her. But also, she starts the movie in the white bra, which again, for 1960, was not overt, but fairly sexual. And she ends the movie before she undresses to get in the shower in a black bra.
I did not notice that. Mm,
very deliberate choice on Hitchcock's part to go from she's virginal, well, pure is a better word for it, I guess, to she's not so pure and she pays the ultimate price.
So the shower scene, it lasts 3 minutes and includes 50 cuts. Most of these shots are extreme close-ups. And there's quick cuts between extreme close-ups, which were used to make the sequence feel more subjective. Hitchcock actually lets you read the quote, because you can do a Hitchcock impression.
Transferring the menace from the screen into the mind of the audience.
And he initially wanted the scene to have no music, but Bernard Herrmann insisted on trying his composition. And when he saw how much the screeching violins elevated the scene, Hitchcock doubled Herman's salary.
And if you look at the documentary, they show the scene without the music.
Yeah.
Still a pretty effective scene, still pretty scary.
Yeah.
But that God, I don't know, maybe second or third most famous, maybe even the number one most famous music cue in the history of motion picture music. That ring, ring, ring.
It's shorthand. I dare you to find one person in North America who's never used that as a shorthand for a violent moment. That ring, ring.
Mm-hmm. I can think of two movies at the top of my head. There are comedies, actually, that use it ironically.
Sure.
Vacation and Wayne's World. Mm-hmm. Wayne's World 2, maybe, but they both use it in a supposedly psychotic sense for a comedic effect. Yeah, and the music is not the only key to the movie, but it's definitely a huge key. Saul Bass. Now, here's two debunkings we're about to do right now.
Yep.
It's been said that Saul Bass directed that scene. I don't know if he said that.
He said that.
Well, he's wrong. Many people, including Janet Leigh, have said Hitchcock directed every frame of that film. There's also apparently a story about how he was off sick one day, and they did part of or all of the Arbogast climbing the stairs where he gets slashed by Norman slash Norma. You've done very well, but you shot a murderer going upstairs. Because apparently it was a close-up of his hand, and it was a close-up of his body parts, rather than showing his face objectively. And, of course, the scene has that great wide shot of him coming up the stairs, where he's just all alone. So they reshot that. The Saul Bass story, I don't believe it, that he directed that shower scene. He storyboarded it.
Yeah,
he
was a visual consultant. And this is why he can claim it, that he directed it. He wasn't necessarily on set, you know, behind the camera, which is everybody's argument. It was Hitchcock there. It was Hitch. He was the one doing it. But apparently there are storyboards that exist that Saul Bass created that are shot by shot.
Well, I don't doubt that, but that'd be like saying the art director of a movie or the cinematographer or the whoever else shot a movie, when the director is the person that oversees all these people and makes it all work.
Yeah.
And directors should share credit, and most of the best ones do share the credit with maybe a dozen department head collaborators, but there should be no one saying, I directed this movie, when they didn't direct the movie.
And Saul Bass, incidentally, is also the artist who created all of Hitchcock's opening titles, right?
Well, not all of them, but for the
many of the ones that are very famous. Yeah,
Vertigo,
yeah,
North, yeah. Northwest, Psycho, three in a row here in the AFI, and others beyond that. The other infamous lie about this, and Janet Leigh has debunked this many times, is that at the moment of when the shower curtain gets pulled back and she screams, the water doesn't suddenly go cold. She has said many times, no, they didn't do anything like that. I acted the scene.
Yeah, yeah.
Hitchcock has said many times, actors should be treated like cattle. But I don't think he was that bad. The stories have always been from Janet Leigh that she's one of the Hitchcock blondes. Now, this is a black and white movie, but she's still a Hitchcock blonde.
Sure.
So even though we're not able to see what color her hair is, she's clearly a blonde.
Well, it's either blonde or it's white.
Yes. But she, as an actress, apparently was one of the people that didn't have to deal with his obsessions. The movie The Girl is all about how Tippi Hedren had to deal with his come-ons on the birds, and then she worked with them again on Marnie. And maybe there are other issues with that, with Vera Miles or Grace Kelly or the other various women he worked with, maybe Doris Day. But Janet Leigh, from all I've ever heard and all the various accounts, is that no, she was no nonsense, and he was completely respectful of her and had this big star in a fairly small role who lasts for literally one third of the movie and yet has one of the most famous roles in the history of a Hitchcock film, but did not get doused with cold water, apparently, in the shower scene. But there are other elements in the film that really work well in a subtextual and sometimes textual kind of way. For one thing, Lee's fake eyebrows, they seem to be very fake to me. They're like slashes on her face. Mm-hmm. Much like the music has that slashing kind of effect right at the beginning. Not even just the ring, 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 but the other music cue in this movie that's so famous is that down, 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 down.
No, keep going.
But both of those music cues have that sort of pounding, driving, slashing kind of effect. Also, when she gets to the hotel, it was a dark and stormy night. That's the great line from any scary movie or any great thriller. If it's a dark and stormy, that's why she had to pull off in the first place. She had to keep driving because the rain drives her off the road.
The rain plays into one of the large motifs in this film, which is the water motif. Apparently, the rain clears up the second she decides to go back to Phoenix and return the money. And then the shower is meant to be like a baptismal scene.
Yeah.
And of course, her body winds up in the filthy swamp getting sucked down.
Yeah. So that's about a rebirth, but what about the beginning of the movie where Sam seems like he may be stringing her along? Is this a playback to The Apartment, which we did last week? Is Sam stringing her along, like Sheldrick does to Miss Kubelik in The Apartment?
I think if that was true, then he wouldn't care so much about finding her in this second half of the movie, where he comes
with
in.
With Lila, okay.
Yeah, and he tries to save Lila. Like, I think he's a good guy. I think he's in love with her. I think he feels bad about
the fact that he can't actually be with her.
Yeah, yeah.
In the sequel, the 1983 movie, Lila is Lila Loomis. So she's married Sam at some point in the years that have followed when Norman goes off to the insane asylum.
There's no hint of romance between them.
No, but I guess it does develop, yeah. I don't think that Lila and Sam had ever met each other until the scene where she goes to his
hardware store
and you see ordinary household type things and yard type things, rakes and that kind of stuff, but they look these threatening things because of the way they shoot it. I think it's a series of rakes behind him and like these daggers, these Freddy Krueger-esque claws that are behind him, which is fascinatingly shot as well.
Yeah, yeah.
And before we get into the cast and crew, I want to use a few quotes because only one of them made the list, but some of these are great. Norman's reflecting in the window when he says this. Mother isn't quite herself today. And also, he says about his mother that she's harmless as one of those stuffed birds. Well, again, she is a stuffed bird.
Bird being another motif in the film. There's his stuffed birds. There's Marion Crane, who comes from Phoenix. Pictures of birds on the wall.
And what was Hitchcock's very next movie?
It was The Birds.
The Birds, right. And the other line I think could have been in there would be, we all go a little mad sometimes.
Yeah, I'm surprised that that wouldn't have even been nominated. That's a pretty memorable
It was nominated.
Oh, it was nominated.
The top 100 quotes list. A few more themes to cover before we get to the cast and crew. The flushing toilet, which apparently had never been done in a Hollywood movie before.
Yeah, they had never shown a flushing toilet.
And that was, of course, to cover over the fact that she's flushing down the totals of what she's subtracted from what she stole.
Yep.
Further implying that she's going to take the money back. She never actually says that to anyone, but we can deduce it from what she's writing on that piece of paper. And also that a major character in this movie isn't even alive. She was alive, but she isn't alive through any of the storyline until we find out at the end. And we'll have that again in an AFI movie in the 60s, but I won't say which one it is because it is a spoiler. All right, so the cast is Psycho. Anthony Perkins is only AFI movie. He also did the Psycho sequels, plus The Trial for Orson Welles and Fear Strikes Out. Fear Strikes Out is a baseball movie where he struggles with daddy issues. Carl Malden plays a really hard-driving baseball dad. And this is his signature role, of course. I did typecast him, but apparently he said he would do it again, even though years later he had issues with the fact he was typecast, but he would have done it again anyway because he knew it was a great role. And then, as I said, he did the sequel, so he obviously came to terms with it.
I will say, having seen the remake first where Vince Vaughn played Norman Bates, this is evidence to me that Vince Vaughn is not a good enough actor to pull it off.
One of the things
a difference having Anthony Perkins in the role. Yeah. I swear that right there what makes it 100 times better movie. Vince Vaughn was terrible as Norman Bates.
I would agree he wasn't good. I don't know if he was quite terrible, but the one thing that I don't like that either was his idea or Gus Van Sant's idea is the little giggle he does. He does it a lot.
He just doesn't pull it off.
Yeah.
And Anthony Perkins totally pulls it off. And it's hard. Like, this is a 10 out of 10 for difficulty. Mm-hmm. It's a very complex role and a complex way to manipulate the audience, manipulate their sympathies. To me, he makes the movie, for me.
I think Vaughn also seems nuts early on and telegraphs where the movie's going. So Janet Leigh, who got the end credit, her first of two AFI films. She's also going to be in one of my favorites from the 60s, The Manchurian Candidate, only a few movies away for us. She was also in Touch of Evil for Orson Welles as well. And she acted for nearly 60 years, a few times with her daughter, Jamie Lee Curtis, including one of the Halloween sequels. Neither Perkins nor Leigh were paid very much money, which is interesting considering their stardom. But then this was a fairly low-budget movie.
Yeah, yeah. There's a very interesting story about how it even got made. And God, we could talk about this movie for days. There was a whole movie made about it, Hitchcock. That movie is about how Psycho got made and how hard Hitchcock had to fight with the studios to get it made in the first place and get it made for a very small budget in the end.
Yeah, after the glitz and glamour of Vertigo and North Northwest and other movies he'd been making through the 50s, he was, as we've said a few times about him, the Spielberg of his day, the constant hit maker, with some exceptions, the guy that could get anything made. If anybody could, it was him. Mm-hmm. Wilder would be another one, I suppose. But here he took things way down. We'll get to him in a minute, though. Let's finish up the cast here. So Vera Miles, her second of two AFI films after The Searchers, which we did a little while ago. And she was also in The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance for Ford and also with John Wayne and Jimmy Stewart. And she was supposed to have played Madeline in Vertigo. Hitchcock wanted her, but she got pregnant. And some have said that he didn't direct her as well as he could have as a revenge, which seems a little stupid. You would think he would want his movie to be as good as it can be with her or whomever else he's going to cast. So I don't know if I really believe that. John Gavin, who apparently Hitchcock called a stiff, played Sam Loomis. This is his first of two consecutive AFI films because he's going to be in Spartacus for us. Won't be next week. It'll be in 2 weeks because we'll tell you why that's going to be. But he is in that one as well. Not a lot of other credits we have to talk about, but he does play Julius Caesar in Spartacus. Martin Balsam, his second of three AFI films. He was also in On the Waterfront and will be in All the President's Men. He was also in both the Cape Fear movies, but of course neither of those were AFI films. Pat Hitchcock, Alfred's daughter, she's in her final of three roles in her father's films, and she is the other secretary in the office, who's not a great actress, I don't think. Definitely nepotism there that she got
the
role.
She's Sofia Coppola, that role.
Yeah, she, nepotism going on there. I think she's in every one of the documentaries that were on the various DVDs for him. She's definitely in most of them. And she's an interesting person to talk about it because she lived with her parents, so she knows an awful lot more than the rest of us would. Mr. Cassidy, the rich guy who is stolen from. How much money? You said it earlier. So it was?
$40,000.
$40,000. Exactly.
Which, adjusted for inflation, would be roughly $318,000. Well, I mean, enough to buy a house,
That's
right?
not nothing.
Yeah.
Yep. No. Well, he was played by Frank Albertson, and that means he was Sam Wainwright in It's Wonderful Life. Hee-haw!
Oh, yeah.
I didn't recognize him. When I looked him up, I thought, where did I know that name from? Oh, right, Sam Wainwright. And then I mentioned Simon Oakland, who is the shrink at the end, who has the explanation scene that takes up too much of the movie, but he's going to be in West Side Story. And he was also in Bullet, So quickly about the ending scene where the psychiatrist explains to everybody what's really going on with Norman, which we probably could have figured out for ourselves even in 1960. But at least it has the last moments where Norma's voice is in Norman, that shot that kind of goes
the
in
voiceover,
on him. And that the very last second, that little bit of a freeze frame of a skull that's over his face before it shows the car being pulled out of the swamp. So the psychiatrist scene maybe doesn't work so well, but the last 30 seconds to a minute do work quite well. And the man directing all of this, we've said him so much already, Alfred Hitchcock, his final of four AFI films. So many of them are crammed together in the 50s and now into the early 60s. He did Rear Window, Vertigo, and North by Northwest. He directed six more movies before he died. The next two were The Birds and Marnie. And a lot of people love those ones, especially Marnie, as much as anything he ever did. Mm-hmm. But I do think that this was his, not my favorite of his films, but this was his peak. This is where his last great film happened. Yeah. I'm not a huge fan of Marnie, and I think The Birds has some good stuff in it. But Tippi Hedren, not a good actress at all. This was the second time he lost the Oscar to Billy Wilder, because Wilder won for The Apartment, and he was nominated five times in total. He never did win a Best Director Oscar. This was the last time he ever got nominated for the Oscar as well. He did win an honorary one years later. And apparently his thank you speech was simply to go up there and say, thank you, when he won the Thalberg Award.
Can you imagine how much anticipation there was for his speech, too? Wow.
Yep. They filmed it at Universal, with Hitchcock apparently foregoing his salary for 60% of that enormous gross.
Well, yeah. He made himself a very rich man. And I think
he was a rich man, so it was worth the gamble.
And then he used the money to buy 15% shares in MCA, I think.
MCA Universal, I guess, became that company. And even though the DVD is a Universal release, a Blu-ray as well, it was a Paramount picture at the time.
That's right.
But they shot it on the lot at Universal.
But he effectively used his profit from that film to make himself his own boss.
He'd been his own producer for many years. We talked about how in all of his films he was the uncredited producer, and he was here again. But his writer was Joseph Stefano. His only AFI film, he also wrote the TV movie Psycho 4 and a lot of other television shows. He's one of the many people in that documentary I talked about, which is a really good documentary. There's a lot of good making ofs on the various DVDs and Blu-rays out there, but that's one of the better ones, the one on Psycho. And he apparently was in therapy and had mother issues, much like Hitchcock had mother issues. So a lot of that plays into this.
Yeah.
He really did work well with Hitchcock. It's not Hitchcock's best screenplay, but it's probably up there. And as far as subtext, it might be the most interesting one.
Well, Freud would love this movie.
Oh, God, would he
I read a theory that the house has three stories because the top floor is the superego,
where
Norman lives. The main floor is the ego, where Norman lives. And the basement is the id, where he hides mother when he's...
Because then the voiceover, which obviously we now know, is him just saying this about her. But she's supposedly saying, you're going to hide me in the fruit cellar again. You think I'm fruity, eh?
Yeah.
And also, I talked so much about that great shot of him coming down the stairs, that crazy look on his face. I have a bit of a thing about basements. We've talked about the basement we have in this house that's a little freaky. I've been in there so often now that I'm kind of past that point.
That's good.
But basements have always sort of freaked me out in the first place. And horror movies have played it up so well.
The Blair Witch
Project. The Blair Witch Project has it so well at the end of that movie, the last
Every
shot.
Every kid is innately scared of the basement, right?
And this movie certainly does that well, too. Because if you look around in that last shot, there's nothing that's really all that scary down there. But it's all about, what is Vera Miles going to go find down there?
Yeah.
And Lila's pretty gutsy to investigate in the first place.
No kidding.
But anyway, Stefano, Hitchcock, all the rest, they base this on Robert Bloch, I guess is how you say his name, B-L-O-C-H, his novel, which apparently was based on Ed Gein, a very infamous serial killer. And his exploits inspired not only this movie, but Texas Chainsaw Massacre and Silence of the Lambs. And he did all kinds of crazy stuff. And there's some pretty disgusting stuff, let's just put it that way. Apparently in the book, Norman is in the beginning of it rather than coming up about 25 or 30 minutes in. And he's also not a sympathetic, nice-looking, boyish
he's older,
type of guy.
He's kind of pudgy. That's
an unlikable loser.
Yeah, that's an important thing that Hitchcock changed.
Yeah, take the boy next door who's going to slash you to death when you least expect it.
By
the way, the shower scene, we didn't talk about this. Apparently Hitchcock wanted to do something about the bath, the Diabolique movie, which had come out a few years before that, made by Henri-Georges Clouzot, who made Wages of Fear, a great film, also made Diabolique. Spoiler about this, but there's a bathtub scene, we'll put it that way. And after this one, somebody apparently wrote Hitchcock, very famous story, and said, after Diabolique and this, I can't put my daughter in the bath, I can't give her a shower, what do I do now? Send her to the dry cleaner. So between the two of them, they really scared people off of using the washroom. As we've mentioned Jaws a few times already, people still, even now after all these years, are a little tentative, at least tentative, about going into oceans. So technically speaking, the movie, as we said, is black and white. It's not VistaVision like Vertigo and North by Northwest. Not glitzy and glamorous. Even Janet Leigh's wardrobe is very ordinary. Mm-hmm. They just went and find her normal clothes, which I think I read somewhere that Jamie Lee Curtis for Halloween also, but that was a low-budget movie, truly low-budget movie, but also bought ordinary clothes that a teenager would wear.
It's kind of realistic in that respect.
Yeah.
Should be.
Makes sense, sure. The choice for black and white was because of the blood in the shower scene. And also to be more like the cheapy black and white horror films that would be made at the time.
To save money.
Hitchcock's idea was, what if somebody who had talent and a good story and a good screenplay made one of those kinds of movies?
A B-film, yeah.
A B-film that becomes an A-film. His cinematographer was John L. Russell, the only AFI film he ever did. He was a TV veteran, including for Hitchcock's TV show, Alfred Hitchcock Presents. He worked on a lot of those. And that was the idea. Let's not go with all the glitzy people he'd worked with in all of his productions before. Yes, he used Saul Bass, George Thomasini, the editor, and other people. But some of the other ones, not the glitzy people.
Yeah.
Robert Burks did most of his movies as a cinematographer, but not this time. Thomasini edited again all four Hitchcock AFI films and nine in total. He also did Selig 17 and Cape Fear. And Bernard Herrmann, here is definitely a big name, did the great music. He also did music on Citizen Kane, Vertigo, North by Northwest, and Taxi Driver. And other scores for things like Cape Fear and Day the Earth Stood Still. He was one of the great composers of all time
Some
of the most classic themes. And this is certainly on the short list of those. And in this score, it was all strings.
Mm-hmm.
That was a challenge that Herrmann gave himself or Hitchcock made for Herrmann or something. And it was such a great score in Hitchcock's mind. Not only did he double his salary, but he gave him the final credit card.
At the top. The
final title card at the top before Hitchcock's director credit. That's saying a lot.
Yeah.
Now, of course, the Writers Guild insists the writer has the last card before that.
Yeah.
And I don't know if I've ever seen a music composer's card be there before. And like in Jaws and Star Wars, the director admitted that the score was a huge reason for the success of the film. You talked about Saul Bass, you did Vertigo, North by Northwest, Spartacus, West Side Story, Goodfellas, all AFI films we've seen. Three of those, we're going to see three more, and he was the title designing fellow, but didn't direct the shower scene. The sets, which were nominated for the Oscar, Joseph Hurley, Robert Clatworthy, and George Milo. That's all we'll say about them. Except that their set that they worked with Hitchcock on, obviously, the very phallic hotel. Now, I read this somewhere many years ago. See if I get this right. The house, which is where the mother is.
Mm-hmm.
Home being a synonym for the mother, and we won't get too much into the truly phallic part of this, but then the hotel has that sort of phallic thing and the pathway that leads up into it, so it's almost vaginal. I'm probably blowing what I read many years before, but it gets into the whole design sequence of how Norman's the hotel, symbolically speaking, Norma is the house.
Yes. Oh, okay.
And the hotel leads with a vaginal entranceway into that.
If you say so.
That's what I read somewhere. I'm quoting somebody else. And here's a behind-the-scenes person I don't think we've ever mentioned officially for the Hitchcock movies, but it's Alma, his wife, who was such a big influence on him in every one of his films. And in that movie that they made, Hitchcock, about this film, the making of this film, she was a huge behind-the-scenes booster of him in many ways. Many people have said that she has more influence than we ever realized.
Too. Yeah,
I'm not sure what the truth of that is, but I know that
they were almost collaborators.
But then in his Lifetime Achievement Award for the AFI, many people have had this award given to him. I think it's yearly. When Hitchcock did it, he focused most of his attention on her. She's apparently the best cook and the best collaborator. And I forget what the quote was exactly, but it was all about Alma Revel, Alma Hitchcock. All right, the influence of Psycho. I think we've talked about them a lot already. The shower scene. People were scared to take showers back then in 1960, and I think probably some of them still are. At least the intimidation factor. I'm sure a lot of people lock their door at the very least when they take a shower, even if they're in a house where there's no way anyone's ever going to knife them to death.
Yeah.
Because you are incredibly vulnerable. Not only are you naked, but where are you going to go? What's your weapon? Soap? I'll clean you to death. Martin Scorsese filmed Jake's big pummeling in Raging Bull. He gets bloodied almost to death based on the shower scene, including the big right-hand punch coming at him like the knife in the shower scene in Psycho.
And as I recall, one of the last shots you see in that scene is blood dripping from the ropes.
We talked a little about the swamp where the car is being sunk by Norman. Mm-hmm. And Brian De Palma, who was a big devotee of Hitchcock, did it so well in Raising Kane, where he's sinking a car, but the person isn't quite dead yet. Let's just put it that way, without giving it away. And it's a pretty good jump moment in that film. I talked about John Carpenter's Halloween, obviously influenced by this film in many ways. Texas Chainsaw was influenced because of Ed Gein. Also the design of the main floor of the house. Now, maybe many houses are designed like this, but when you walk into the main floor of the house, you've got the staircase leading upstairs to the right as you face it, and then off to the left of that, leading back to whatever it might be in Texas Chainsaw, that's what leads to the kill room and that great opening where we first see that. So they're kind of similar. And then to the left of that, as you walk into the house, would be things like the parlor and the dining room and all that stuff, which is also where those things were in Texas Chainsaw. And then, of course, the biggest influence would be the many sequels, the TV movies, the spin-off prequel TV show that's on Netflix and TV right now. And of all those, Psycho 2 is a pretty solid sequel. I don't want to give away what happens in that movie, but if you've never seen it, I do recommend it. It's a pretty good follow-up to this one, where he gets out of the asylum after many years, but this storyline is not dead yet. And as I said, Vera Miles is actually in it as an older version, as Anthony Perkins, as an older version of himself. Vera Miles is playing Lila Loomis, who's not letting her sister die without a fight. Put it that way.
Yeah.
And I recommend that one. Certainly not as good as this film. Certainly not an AFI film, but a pretty good thriller. And even Psycho 3, which I think Perkins directed, has some pretty good moments in it, too. It has a lot of failures in it, but it has some great stuff in it.
I can't believe you mentioned De Palma and you failed to mention Dress to Kill. That movie's almost an homage, where you actually, in the end, have a transvestite murderer. There's lots of psychology involved in that as well. It's a very psychoanalytical thriller. And you can't fail to mention other films that copied Hitchcock's technique of offing the biggest star of the movie in the first act. Scream is a great example. And in that example, it works really well. I would also say The Shining, even though Scatman Crothers wasn't the biggest star of the film, since him coming to rescue them is such a big plot point, for him to just kind of unceremoniously and very suddenly die
the second he gets into the hotel. And in the book, he does save them.
Yeah, that's right. And that's something that Kubrick did differently. There's times when it's been done and could very much be considered a failure. The example I'm thinking of is Death Proof, where you have a bunch of main characters that die halfway through the film, and it just kind of takes all the steam out of the movie, and I don't think Tarantino ever really gains that back.
I think he said somewhere that that's the worst one he ever does. He'll be okay with that.
Oh, yeah, I agree. I still love Death Proof, don't get me wrong. I still think it's a very good movie that happens to have this one flaw, which is perhaps that he was trying to do this thing that Hitchcock did, and he kind of failed.
Yeah, when you dare to kill off most of your cast.
Yeah.
And then reset the movie. It's a daring thing to do. And to ask people to go from sympathizing with one to sympathizing with somebody else entirely, at least in the case of Death Proof, it is other women.
And then this is something that Psycho does that you really have to respect it for. A 10 out of 10 for difficulty to take the audience's allegiance and shift it so dramatically.
One of the other great influences on this would be the William Castle-esque marketing campaign that they did.
Yes.
Hitchcock apparently had this thing where he put up these big cutouts of himself, or was written on there, that you can't get into Psycho after it started. You can't come in late. I don't think that would matter if you want to stay for multiple versions.
And apparently people used to do that. They would just show up to the theater whenever they felt like it and then walk into whatever movie was playing at whatever point it was playing at.
But Hitchcock didn't want people to be mad that they... Where's Janet Leigh if they came in maybe 45 or 15 minutes
and
apparently, she's not in the movie anymore?
Apparently the lineups that produced, because people had to wait for the next screenings to start, was part of what worked for the marketing as well, because everybody was like, look how popular this film is.
One of those must-see movies. And also everyone would say, don't give away the secrets to Psycho. Apparently he bought up as many copies of the book as he possibly could.
Yeah, that's right.
No one could know what the twist
was. Yeah, yeah.
All right, so the very impressive AFI lists and awards section. So the four Oscar nominations for Hitchcock, his last one as Best Director, Lee as Supporting Actress, the cinematography for Russell, and the sets. Of course, didn't win any of those because Hitchcock's AFI films didn't win anything. The National Film Registry in 1992, 3 years into their project. Would have thought it maybe would make the very first year. The four AFI lists, apart from, of course, the two main ones, and all pretty impressive ranks here. I talked about other quotes, but this one did make it. A Boy's Best Friend Is His Mother was 56 on the top 100 quotes list. The score was fourth, top 25 music scores. Norman Bates was second in the Rogues Gallery of Heels on the Heroes and Villains list. And by the way, that's interesting. If you've never seen the movie before but happened to have caught that list, it would be blown for you right then and there.
Yeah, that's right.
And number one, the top 100 thrills with Jaws and Exorcist being number two and number three. And interesting in all three cases, Psycho is about something that has a lot of, I wouldn't call them dead spots, but non-horrifying, non-thrilling, non-exciting spots. Jaws is all about, I love Jaws, but just don't go in the water. And The Exorcist is about something that a lot of people don't believe in the first place, which is the devil taking over a girl's body. But what about the AFI's most thrilling movie, the 14th and 18th greatest movie of all time? What are your last Psycho thoughts?
Well, I think that this conversation just proves what a great film it is, because not only was it a really entertaining, fun film to watch, but look how fun it is to talk about. There are just so many interesting things to sink your teeth into. It's a film that's deceptively deep.
Yes.
And it is the film that finally won me over for Hitchcock. So
what he's finally done.
Yeah.
We've gone on a long time. This is one of our longer podcasts. But it's also a movie that I don't know if we really got into as much as we could have. We could probably talk for another hour.
Yeah.
Full hour.
Absolutely.
On this one.
Yeah, there's so much to get into with it. It's a shame. But an hour's long enough.
And one of the great twist endings in the history of movies. And playing into that is next week's podcast. Next week, we're going to change gears and bring you the sixth edition of the Not 100 Project. This one will be a timely podcast lineup with the July 11th release of Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, because we're going to review Charlton Heston and those damned filthy monkeys in the original 1968 sci-fi classic Planet of the Apes, which also has one of the most infamously given away endings in the history of movies. So, playing into that, the coming attractions trivia for Planet of the Apes. What's the most shocking twist or simply the best ending in any AFI movie? This is an opinion thing now. I've never done that before with these coming attractions trivia questions. These are the ones I picked, and there's other ones up for debate for sure. Psycho, The Sixth Sense, Citizen Kane, Chinatown, 2001 A Space Odyssey, or is it non-AFI-er, Planet of the Apes?
All right. Well, I will have to think that over. But we would love to hear your answer. Please send us an email. Our address is top100projectpodcast@gmail.com. If you'd like more from Ryan and me, please visit our website, top100project.com. Don't forget to subscribe to the Top 100 Project on iTunes. You can also find us at our home, Podomatic, top100project.podomatic.com.
It's been hot in here. I'm a little sweaty. Gonna go take a shower. But I'm gonna lock the door. I'm really gonna lock the door.
And cut.